Okay.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks to you for organizing this very nice program, to Grisha too. And well, I will talk about the large scale of turbulent geophysical flow, two-dimensional turbulence, using statistical mechanics ideas. Then, well, I hope you will stop me to ask me any question you would ask, you would like. Then I first want to thank my collaborators for their work together with me. Then there is Antoine Venaille. I will speak about the equilibrium statistical mechanics applied to ocean jets and vortices. And he made a lot in this part of the work. I will speak about bistability, random change of flow topology in the 2D Navier-Stokes equation with Eric Simonet and with Hidetoshi Morita. I won't speak much about this this thing. Marianne Korvelek is currently a PhD student. Probably I won't have time to speak about what we did together. And I will finish by bistability situation and non-equilibrium phase transition in an recent experiment that has been done by Manny Mathure in Léger in Grenoble together with Joël Sommeria. Then the type of physical phenomena I want to study is the self-organization of the larger scale of turbulent flow, typically what we see in geophysical turbulence. And geophysical turbulence, meaning here a flow which is dominated by the Coriolis force and for which we have quasi-bidimensionality. What I mean by quasi-bidimensionality means that there are some extra invariants like the entropy or potential entropy of or others that make the energy to go towards the larger scale. Then these flows are three-dimensional, but they are quasi-two-dimensional in this meaning. Then here there are some classical picture. You can see the great red spot of Jupiter, and then the flow is very well organized. You see the spot itself. It's really turbulent. When you see films, you can clearly see lots of instabilities, things at all scale. But still, the structure of the larger scale is stationary. The great red spot is observed for more than three centuries with the same structure. The zonal velocity profile here, the zonal velocity, that is the velocity in this direction, is nearly constant a long time with some small fluctuation. And this is a feature that is unusual in turbulent flow. This is really different from what is observed in a three-dimensional flow. And this is basically a characteristic of these types of flow that are dominated by Coriolis force and that are quasi two-dimensional. This picture is the height, the sea surface height of the North Atlantic, and the measure from a satellite. And this is the coast of North America, the United States. And for instance, between the blue and the red, here you have something like 2.5 meters. And it's a somewhat high denivellation. And you can see clearly a sharp gradient here.
Meters of height?
Of height, yes.
Of water.
Of water. Then,
big vortex like this.
Well, it's yes, it's something like a big vortex. And along this big gradient, this strong gradient here, then you have a pressure gradient due to this denivellation. And this pressure gradient is balanced by the Coriolis force. When you have a pressure gradient like this, the Coriolis force is perpendicular. Then the velocity will be along this line. And basically what you see here is a very strong jet. Directly on this picture, and this very strong jet is nothing else but the Gulf Stream, actually, and this is what you see here in a very schematic map, the type of map you can find in a children textbook. Then the main point I want to make here is that this structure is nearly turbulent. You have a spectrum with developed scales and time scale with a very wide range. Still, you have this structure which is nearly permanent. It is unstable, it has some motion, some instabilities, But the overall structure of the flow on the larger scales remains always the same. Then this is unusual for turbulent flow. I mean, three-dimensional turbulence flow, the larger scales are always unstable and they always break down in smaller and smaller scale. Then what I would like to try to do, what I will be able to do, but only very scarcely, is that to try to explain that this is like a self-organization process. We have a huge numbers of degrees of freedoms. The Reynolds numbers are extremely high. Then we would like to explain this using statistical mechanics. And of course, all these flows are non-equilibrium flow. Then we don't really have the good theoretical concept to be able to predict the larger scale of this flow. But still, in some special cases, we may argue that we will be not far from equilibrium and try to use equilibrium statistical mechanics. And I will try to convince you about that in these talks, and I will discuss both equilibrium and non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. Then I will work with very simple model, with the quasi-geostrophic model that describes this type of flow I have shown before, and with the Navier-Stokes equation and Euler equation, which are some academic model, but with the same structure as the quasi-geostrophic model. Then here I begin with the two-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. Then this is the simplest model for these types of problems. This is the usual Navier-Stokes equation. For a two-dimensional flow, because the flow is in the plane, the curl of the flow is along the axis normal to the plane. Then the curl of the flow is a scalar. Then the vorticity is a scalar. It's much more simple to write the equation for the vorticity than to write the equation for the velocity. And this is the usual Navier-Stokes equation. And you have the inertial terms, the viscous dissipation. Usually for the two-dimensional or quasi-two-dimensional flow, there are some linear friction that comes from the boundary layers or that are just effective models to describe large-scale dissipation. And this is what I put here, and here I have added some random forces. Then, as I said, this is an academic model, but there are lots of experimental realization. We have seen a very interesting talk a few days ago about experimental realization of 2D turbulence. There are lots of other types of realization, rotating tank experiments, magnetic flow, plasma, and so on. And basically, there are a strong analogy with the geophysical flow because the structure of the equation is the same as the structure of a quasi-geostrophic model. And when I will speak about equilibrium, I will refer to what happens for the 2D Euler equation. The 2D Euler equation is the same as before, but for a perfect flow. That is, I have no more any of the forces or the dissipative terms. Then here, I will define the stream function psi. I have not said it, but I am talking about a divergence-less flow. Then we can use the velocity as a curl of a stream function. And then what will be very important is that there are plenty of stationary solutions for the 2D Euler equation. If you try to say, I want these terms to be zero, then u dot nabla omega equal to zero, then this is not equivalent actually, but any of the solution of this equation, omega equal f of psi for any function f, will be a steady solution for the 2D Euler equation. Then we will see that this steady solution just acts as attractors for the dynamics of the 2D Euler equation. Then basically, we will see that the flow will go towards such a steady solution. We have an infinity of them for any function f. We have an infinity of them that are stable. Then the main point in what I will discuss is what will select this function f. which mechanism will be selecting this function f. And as far as the 2D Euler equation is concerned, without forces and without friction, what I will argue is that f can be selected, can be predicted using classical equilibrium statistical mechanics. Then another point important is that the 2D Euler equation is an Hamiltonian system. It is time reversible, and there are lots of invariants associated to this dynamics. There is the usual energy, which is just the kinetic energy, but there are lots of other invariants. Any invariants of these types, which are called Casimirs, the circulation is one of those, the entropy, which is the second moment of the vorticity, is another one, but there are an infinity of other ones. And basically, the conservation of all of these invariants is equivalent to the conservation of the vorticity distribution. Basically, if you have some value for a vorticity initially, just like colors for when you mix color, the area of the colors is conserved. And here it's exactly the same. This is what means this. And it is exactly equivalent to the conservation of all this quantity here. Then, as far as geophysical flow are concerned, I will use a model which is called the 1.5 layer quasi-geostrophic model, or it is called also the Charney-Hasegawa-Mima equation. It describes a layer of fluid in the limit of small Rossby numbers for very strong rotation. And it describes the evolution of a field Q, which is called the potential vorticity. And you see that the structure of the equation is exactly the same. It's just a transport equation by a divergence flow. The difference is resides in the relation between the field and the stream function or the velocity, which is different in the two cases. What will be important is that when we compute the stream function of the velocity from the potential vorticity, we have to invert this operator here. And there is a length scale associated to that. The interaction is screened at some value of, at some distance. This length scale is called the Rossby deformation radius. With this formula, omega is the rotation, the angular rotation of the planet or the tank. G is the gravity acceleration, and H is the height of the flow. Then this length is basically a typical size for the gradient of the pressure in the flow. For instance, it's the typical size for the width of the Gulf Stream I have shown you. It's the typical size of the jets that forms the Great Red Spot, or it's the typical size of cyclones or anticyclones on the Earth. Then this is a very important physical parameter. Then I will follow the following plan. I will begin with explaining you what is statistical mechanics in this framework and how we recently applied it to describe ocean mesoscale eddies, some vortices in the ocean, and the jets like the Gulf Stream or equivalent thing. Then I will come back adding forces and dissipation and to show you some experimental result and some numerical works we did showing that in some circumstances we are indeed close to equilibrium. And thanks to that we are able to predict random transition in numerical simulation or in experiments. And probably I won't have much time to speak to you about this last part where we found some result about the inviscid relaxation of the two-dimensional Euler equation. When I begin with the statistical equilibrium, then everybody here knows that obtaining theoretical result for statistical hydrodynamics is a very difficult problem. There are very scarce results, except, for instance, the result obtained by Grisha and over on the Kreichnein model. I mean, real results in this field are very scarce. But what I wanted to stress here is that It may be much simpler to get some theoretical result for two-dimensional or geophysical flow in some of their regime. Why it may be much simpler? Just because there is a regime where this flow actually are close to conservative systems and where statistical mechanics, equilibrium statistical mechanics, may help us to have some hints on what happens for this flow. Then, to use equilibrium statistical mechanics to explain the self-organization of this flow is a very old idea. Basically, the first idea was by Onzager in 1949. Onzager was working with an Hamiltonian system, which is an approximation of the 2D Euler equation that is called the point vortex model. Then this model has been studied further by lots of people, physicists, plasma physicists, fluid mechanics, mathematicians. And later on in the 90s, there have been some extension of these types of work to cope with really the 2D Euler equation, continuous vorticity field, by Robert and Someria and Miller. And this is basically in the context of the Robert Someria Miller theory that I will work at least on the first part of the talk when I speak about equilibrium statistical mechanics. Then what is exactly this Robert Someria Miller theory? Then the point is to describe the statistical equilibrium. Then there is some difficulties to make equilibrium statistical mechanics because it's a field, and basically you don't know exactly how to do the statistical mechanics of a field. It can have possibly a specific heat which is infinite and lots of problems associated to that. For instance, if you try to make the statistical mechanics of a 3D Euler equation just with the conservation of the energy, you find nothing really relevant. You find a spectrum that describes equipartition, but that is not physical. This is what happens most of the times for fields when you try to make statistical mechanics. There is a big difference, however, for 2D turbulence, and the main point is it's because of this conservation law for the potential vorticity. Then the statistical mechanics goes this way. I said to you that the value of the vorticity were conserved. Then we will define the probability rho to observe the value of the potential vorticity or the vorticity to be equal to some number at some point x. And it's a local probability to observe a value for the vorticity or for the potential vorticity. Then we may ask the most probable mixing of all of these values. We mix them, and there is a classical answer to that. If we can consider the two points are uncorrelated, then the classical answer, basically given by Boltzmann, it's a generalization of this, is that the Boltzmann-Gibbs entropy describes you the most probable mixing of this value. And this is this entropy. Basically, you have to make something like a mean field approximation, something that tells you that it's actually uncorrelated. But you can prove using something called from the Liouville theorems and using something called the Sanoff theorem of probability, but this is indeed true if you try to build the microcanonical measure for the 2D Euler equation. I don't discuss this. Here I just assume this entropy as describing actually the microcanonical measures. Then the statistical equilibria are given by the maximization of this entropy with some constraints. And the only constraints we keep is this conservation law, the energy and the initial value of the vorticity, which are conserved. And basically, without these constraints, maximizing this, we would obtain something completely uniform. The vorticity field will be uniform. But it's impossible to get the vorticity field uniform because it would give you an energy with some value which is not the actual one. Then if you add this as a constraint, you will find the most the most mixed state, but with some fixed energy. Then this is what describes this equilibrium statistical mechanics. And when you do the mathematics associated to this maximization, you find that the average potential vorticity locally is equal to a function of psi, the stream function. And this predicts you a steady state. And this function f depends on the value of the invariants in a complicated way, but still, in principle, you can deduce f from the value of the invariants. Then, basically, if you have a problem like this one that you want to model, then it would predict you what would be the outcome of the evolution of any initial condition. And this prediction would depend on the value of the invariant initially. And it explains you why you see this emerging from random initial condition. It gives you some result about the stability of the structures, and it explains why the flow is so predictable. Then this is really powerful, and the reason why it is powerful is because it's based on a very simple idea, the idea that you will visit the phase space as uniformly as possible. Then we applied this years ago with Joël Sommeria to the great red spot, actually, and we have shown that the statistical equilibrium of the quasi-geostrophic models gives actually a good description of the observed velocity field. Here we have a jet which is very narrow, a shape which is very characteristic, a shear outside, and we find back all this property, and we are able to get the correct order of magnitude for all of this. And what I want to show you today is some other works we did recently with Antoine Venaille to try to model simple ocean features using the statistical mechanics ideas. And I will work in the framework of the quasi-geostrophic model, the model I already discussed before. There is a slight difference. I have added here a term which is called the beta effect, and which is related to the variation of the Coriolis force with the latitude. And it's linear in y, one of the coordinates, and I will see the consequences of this. Then this is a model I will use for the upper part of the ocean. Then it is an extremely rough model of an ocean, but it's the simplest one. It includes all the necessary physics to understand the self-organization of the flow for the larger scale. Then I will ask two simple questions for this model.
The ocean on the surface, or was the
no, no.
Meters are mixing?
Well, not the mixing layer, not what is called the mixing layer, but the part of the ocean that is between 0 and -1,000 meters, where you have something like called the Peacock line. For instance, oceanographers can make realistic models of these things using three layers model, something like that. Here, what I use is simply a one layer model. But I will show you some dynamics of that afterwards. And basically, it's technically, this describes you when you decompose the velocity fields in modes. It describes you what gives you the main baroclinic mode. Then the question are the following. Can we use statistical mechanics, and can we describe with statistical mechanics the eddies that populate the ocean and their properties, and can we use statistical mechanics to explain why there is this organization in strong jet like the Gulf Stream or the Kuroshio. Then I begin with the ocean rings, and I begin by showing you a picture, a snapshot of a velocity field that has been computed by Alberg and Gnada Desikian in GFDL. Then this is the velocity field, and this is the Antarctic circumpolar current, and you can see that there are annular vortices everywhere in the ocean, and these vortices have a very characteristic scale. Basically, they have something like 10 times the Rossby deformation radius, 100 of kilometers.
The radius now depends on the position.
Exactly, yes. Right, it depends on the position, but the order of magnitude is 10 to 30 kilometers. And you can see these vortices everywhere. They are sometimes called Gulf Stream rings. These are called Agulhas rings. There are the Medes, which come from the discharge of the water from the Mediterranean Sea, and so on. And what I show you here is an empirical study from satellite data by Shelton and collaborators, where they have tracked the position of these features from maps that they obtained from satellite data. And this is the initial point where they find the vortex, and then you see their position as a function of time here. And you can see that they all go in the same direction, basically towards the west. And here you can see a curve of their speed. I mean, the points have a measure speed towards west. And you can see that it depends, on average, it depends on the latitude. And actually, it depends on the latitude because the Rossby deformation radius depends on the latitude. And these black curves you can see here is what is called, it is beta tilde R square, the variables that I have shown before. And it is the non-dispersive velocity, the velocity of non-dispersive baroclinic waves. But these structures are not waves, they are vortices. And here you can see on this plot a slight tendency for these vortices to go either poleward for the cyclones or equatorward for the anticyclone. Then it's not for all of them, but it's statistically significant. Then from this empirical data, we conclude that more or less the vortices drift westward with this velocity beta tilde R square. And there is also a slight tendency which is correlated to go poleward or northward with much smaller velocity, which is correlated to the sign of the potential vorticity. Then I will begin the study by the case where when beta tilde is zero, just for simplicity. Then I have no more of these terms here proportional to beta tilde. Then there is a bit of mathematics to prove that the statistical mechanics problem is equivalent to the minimization of this free energy here, where phi is a field which is related to psi. Then this is these types of variational problem is called it's called the van der Waals-Canilliard problem. It's very classical in thermodynamics. It describes actually the equilibrium of a gas with its liquid, or more generally, the equilibrium between two phases. Then it's easy to solve this physically in the limit when R goes to zero. There are also lots of mathematical results for that. And here we are in a case where the specific free energy has a double well shape. Then we want to minimize this. The value of the field will be either one or the other of these two minima, like that. But there is a constraint that fixes basically the mass. Then it cannot be the same value everywhere, and there must be some interface somewhere. And because of these terms here, the interface will be. A surface something with a minimal surface for a fixed volume. Then this is basically what describes bubbles in an equilibrium situation. And then from these variational problems, from the variational problem of statistical mechanics, we see that these vortices in the limit R small should be something like a bubble, a sharp interface of a typical size R, the Rossby deformation radius. And with a constant radius of curvature, which is related to the thermodynamical parameters, just like the Laplace equation. And this is actually similar to what is observed for these rings. I mean, for instance, I look at the velocity modulus plotted here for this statistical equilibria, it's a very sharp interface. It is quiet inside, quiet outside, and the typical size of this interface is R. And this is what is described by the equilibrium statistical mechanics for this model. And it's quite simple. And now I will come back to adding this term, beta tilde y, and I will work in a channel geometry, a geometry that will be independent through a change, for a translation along the x-axis. Then there is a new invariant given by fluid mechanics and the Noether's theorems, this L, which is the average value of potential vorticity weighted by the distance y. And when we add this new invariant to make the statistical mechanics, we obtain slightly different equation, but we can show that the solution are exactly the same as before, but in a reference frame that drift with a constant velocity v, and this constant velocity is exactly the same as the one for the baroclinic wave, the non-dispersive baroclinic wave. Then basically what we claim is that, well, the fact that it was this velocity is well known for a long time, but basically on empirical ground, basically from numerical simulation. And what we claim is that statistical mechanics explain why these ocean rings are as this ring structure, why they are called rings, and why they drift with this velocity. There is slightly more in our paper. Basically, we argue that if the relaxation towards equilibrium is not complete, then if the vortex has still to homogenize the potential vorticity, then because of the conservation of this L, cyclones will have actually the tendency to go northward, cyclone will have the tendency to go poleward, and anticyclone will have a tendency to go southward.
Then, Freddy, what's the lifetime of those rings? I mean, why can you do statistical mechanics? You have to wait for a long time?
Basically, it's a very interesting question. Why does statistical mechanics work here? It's because it's a very rapid process. I mean, these rings are formed, for instance, for the regular current. It's the instability of a large-scale current. Then it's an instability, and the instability then go towards something which saturates, and this saturation is this self-organized structure. And this is very quick, something like a few weeks to form them. And once they are formed, they basically go through the ocean and they break down when they reach the opposite side of the coast. Then because this process is extremely rapid, I mean, you can, in this process, you can neglect any dissipation and forcing, statistical mechanics should work. I don't go much into the details, but there are lots of ocean features where statistical mechanics would be stupid to try to use, because lots of ocean features really depends on the forcing mechanism, on the detail of the forcing. But there are some of them where I think we can use it.
You use the dissipation-less approach, master, because it's fast. But what I need, man, that for statistical mechanics, for maximal entropy argument, you need large time. You want system to visit all the phase space so that it will be able to find its form.
Exactly.
It must be some kind of other argument that says that it's long enough. Not long as a bit short.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, basically, you have to compare a typical timescale for the dissipative process, I mean, the dissipation and the forcing, to a typical timescale for visiting all the phase space, right? And you want the second one to be shorter than the first one for statistical mechanics to apply. You want to be able to...
You want it to be longer than, say, an editor of a time. You want some mixing in there.
Right, exactly. An editor of a time is a typical time scale for the beginning of visiting the phase space. Right. Then you need a longer time scale to visit the phase space, really. And then you have even a longer time scale where you will have dissipative process that will become important. Then here the time scale needed for forming these vortices is a few days, 1 week, something like that. Then they remain in the ocean for a very long time, and basically they are little affected by dissipation or things like that.
But you can imagine forcing on the ocean through wind.
Right.
So that then there would be forcing, and then there wouldn't be statistical.
Exactly. Time. This is why I say that not all the phenomena in the ocean can be described like that. I mean, you must have very rapid phenomena, very rapid visiting of the phase space compared to the dissipation mechanism. Let me show you actually something which is forced by wind. I just conclude that, well, we argue that these ocean rings are statistical equilibria, and we can explain their qualitative drift properties. Then let's talk about the ocean basin now, the Gulf Stream, for instance. And this is actually, when you read textbooks in ocean dynamics, the basic explanation you find for that, it's actually a wind-driven model for that. And this is typically a problem where the forcing mechanism is very important. Still, I will show you some film that has been made by Pavel Berlov. And it's a very simple model by an oceanographer of what is a Gulf Stream. And it is a two-layer quasi-geostrophic model. And it's not exactly the same model as the one I study, but it's very similar in the spirit. And you can see here the potential vorticity, the stream function, the velocity, and the relative vorticity in the upper layer. And it's typically what is called a double gyre forcing, exactly what happens in the real ocean. You have a forcing which gives you a sign which has a double gyre configuration. And you see it's very analogous to the Gulf Stream. Of course, there are not all the complexity of the real Gulf Stream, but still you clearly see these very strong jets that oscillate, that form rings, and so on. And it's really a non-equilibrium thing. I mean, you have really a balance between forces and dissipation. You have fluxes of energy, fluxes of potential vorticity.
I think if I do understand well, you have the forcing across the whole layer of the ocean you are talking, since you have this this gradient of pressure.
Here it's a two-layer model, then basically only the upper layer is forced.
Yes, but in comparison to wind forcing is just a surface forcing, that you have a layer forcing here.
Well, yes, I mean, you are right, but I mean, when you read an ocean dynamics textbooks, then they explain you that the effect of the complex effects of forming waves, transferring momentum, and so on to the mixing layer, and then this layer transfer momentum to a larger portion of the ocean, and so on. And oceanographers used to model this just by an effect on a surface which is larger. Then basically, it is just a roof modelization of what reality is, but still, it's a relevant one. I mean, it is actually what is used in a couple ocean models. Okay, but I don't want to. Okay. It's not my point to discuss this. Okay, I take the model as it is and try to understand its dynamics and to see if statistical mechanics can help us understanding this. I mean, what I want to show you here is that a very distinguishing feature is that you have something like a segregation between positive and negative value of the vorticity, nearly uniform, with a sharp interface in between. And this is the point I want to make, is that actually in the problem I was talking about before, there is another solution but this bubble. There is another solution where you have uniform mixing with a very sharp interface in between, and this interface should be a straight line by minimization of the interface length. When you see that it's really different, I mean, this is really turbulent, this is really stationary, but the tendency towards forming uniform zone of potential vorticity is exactly the same, and this uniform zone of potential vorticity are straight jets which scale the proper way.
So, Freddy, you're saying that in a turbulent fluid there are transients.
Yes.
That are attracted by the statistical mechanic equilibria.
Right.
They are going to be disturbed by, external forces of dissipation.
Right. Exactly. I mean, this is in the case of decaying turbulence. And then there are a case like this one of non-equilibrium steady states, balance between forces and dissipation. And if the typical time scale for this balance is much longer than the typical time scale for the organization of the flow, then at leading order we should expect something like equilibrium statistical mechanics. Then at the next leading order there will be actually the balance between the forcing on one hand and the dissipation on the other hand. Then, what time is it? Then there is actually, I won't discuss it in details, but there is actually something which is negative for statistical mechanics here, is that these types of jets are not global statistical equilibria due to the beta effect. Then we have studied this in detail, then this is a negative point for equilibrium statistical mechanics, but we have explained it in quite details. We have talked about metastable statistical equilibrium, and we conclude that I don't discuss this because of lack of time, but you have to know that. Then we conclude that ocean mesoscale vortices are statistical equilibria, that the global statistical equilibria for the Gulf Stream, for instance, are flow with strong mid-basin westward jets, but they flow in the opposite direction. They are incompatible with the actual forcing for the wind. And then we have concluded that they may be metastable states, and it depends on the parameters, which is a balance between the beta effect and the other parameter. But I don't discuss this in details. Then there are both positive and negative points for statistical equilibrium statistical mechanics in this message. Okay, then most of this work has been done in collaboration with Antoine Venay, which is now in postdoc in GFDL with Jove Vallis. And he is not here, he was not to come, Geoffrey Vallis? No? Well, okay. Now I want to take the short amount of time remaining to speak about non-equilibrium problem. When I come back to the Navier-Stokes equation, then I add again a stochastic force and some friction and viscous dissipation. And this problem has been studied by many other people. I will cite a few of them. For instance, there have been works by Kolmkonoten, Mika Chertkov, Kolokolov, Lebedev. This is an example of a numerical simulation by Kolmkonoten. I think there is no large-scale dissipation in this case, and the Kolm has shown that there is a self-similar growth of the large scale structure and studied this in detail, studied how there is maybe some scaling law here in between. There have been also works recently, experiments by Schatz in collaboration with Richard Falkovich. There is also lots of mathematicians that have been interested by this type of problems. Here it's the same 2D Navier-Stokes equation. They don't have linear friction on the larger scale. And this problem has been studied by lots of very interesting people from the mathematical physics community, like Kuksin, Sinai, Shrikian, Bricmont, Kupianen, and so on. And they have proven mathematical types of results, for instance, existence of some stationary measure, how this measure scales in the limit when there is a small friction and a small dissipation, relation with the stationary measures of the Euler equation. But we would like to study this on a more physical ground, and basically the main question we ask is what will we observe on the larger scale. Before to go on, I want to see what I call non-equilibrium phase transition or random change of flow topology or these types of things. And I begin with some experimental results. This one is already quite old by people in the group of Harry Sweeney. And it's a rotating tank experiment, fastly rotating tank. Then you see the tank here. The flow is nearly two-dimensional because of the fast rotation. This gray area here is a topography. Then the topography has some impact on the flow. Basically, a proper model for this would be a barotropic model, something in between the 2D Euler equation and the quasi-geostrophic model I used before. And what you can see on the right plot here is the velocity measure at that point here as a function of time. And this is the time and the velocity. And you clearly see that there are two very different states, two different attractors, and the system switch from one to the other, probably randomly on time, even if this has not been studied empirically. Then here you can see the stream function for each of these two states. And they have called this state the block state because it is out, because it, there is an analogous thing in the atmosphere for the Earth, and it is people from atmosphere science call this a block state, and they call this a zonal state. Basically, this state here is modified a lot by the topography, and this one much less. And you have random switch from one to the other states. Of course, such bistability is ubiquitous in turbulent problems. I show you one of them here, the VKS experiment. Jean-François Pinton told us about that last week. You have random switch between different polarity. This is a random switch for the real Earth. But there are hundreds of examples like that. You have random switch in turbulent convection, in von Karman and Quad turbulence. You have the weather regime in the atmosphere. You have, for instance, the bistability of the Kuroshio current. The Kuroshio is the equivalent of the Gulf Stream, but for the Pacific Ocean, then it flows along the Japan coast and then goes inside the ocean. And sometimes you can see its path here that have been monitored. And sometimes the path goes along the coast, sometimes the path makes a large excursion. And this is what you see here, for instance, on this picture. And it's a bistable situation. The typical time scale for switching from one to the other is something like 10 years, 10 to 20 years. Well, all this to conclude that there are lots of situations of random change from one type of attractor to the other in turbulent flow. And what I want to say you here is that using equilibrium statistical mechanics, we can predict these types of things, but only in this framework of 2D flow or quasi-geostrophic flow. We cannot go further, but still here we can predict non-equilibrium phase transition. Then I come back to my equation, and I want to study the limit of weak forces and weak dissipation. Then first I have, you see that I have put the same value for the coefficient here and there. Then this is just a change of time unit. There is nothing here special. I mean, I know from the beginning my energy input. I know from the beginning the friction, which will be my loss of energy. Then I know the proper time scale I should use in order to balance them on average. Then when I choose the appropriate time units, I can put the same value in front of these two coefficients. Then I am left then with two non-dimensional parameters, a Reynolds number based on the large-scale friction and a Reynolds number based on the small-scale dissipation. And I will work in a limit when both of these Reynolds numbers are large, meaning that all these terms will be small on average compared to what happens due to the Hamiltonian dynamics. Basically, more simply, it means that my turnover time will be much smaller than the typical time I need to force my system. Or my turnover time will be much smaller than the typical time needed for my system to decay to zero. And if I have such a time scale separation, then all these terms are relatively small compared to that one. Then at leading order, I expect to have something like the Euler equation. And then at leading order, I expect to see the same phenomenology as the one I described before. My systems will be attracted by some steady states of the Euler equation. And the basic question is which one and what does select it? When I am unable to answer the question theoretically, I mean, we began to make some type of kinetic theory approach to that, but it's only on an early stage. It is extremely difficult. But still, based on what we learned on the equilibrium statistical mechanics, we can make some qualitative prediction.
You have the magenta terms are small or negligible, you don't have a cascade. You have the equilibrium state for the system. While if those terms are there, even if they're small, you have completely different dynamics.
Yes, that's a very important point. I should have made this point before. I mean, there are two very different regimes in two-dimensional turbulence. I mean, if you would have no boundary on the larger scale, no friction on the larger scale, then you would have an inverse cascade for the larger scale. And this is one regime, one very interesting regime. But there is another regime when your energy will actually reach the box size, okay, and then you will condensate and form large scale structure. And we are studying this second regime only. Then I don't know if you would like to call this a cascade. I mean, you still have a flux of energy from your forcing scale to the large scale, but it's no more a cascade in the sense that it's a local process. It's no more a cascade in the sense that there is an inertial range. Then you just have a flux of energy towards the larger scale. Okay? And then the point, and everything is dominated by the condensate, by the larger scale. And the point I just want to make is that this condensate has some typical time scale associated to it, the turnover time. And there is a typical time scale to force the structure or to dissipate it. And I assume that there is a time scale separation between these two types of
so
processes.
So you say it is not stationary then?
It can be stationary anyway.
If it's getting stationary at the moment that its turnover time is getting over the 1 over alpha, right?
Yes, right. But I wait for sufficiently long time for this to happen. Okay, I wait a very, very long time when it will be actually be stationary. Okay, but at any time this
term. Now you consider it stationary or non-stationary?
Stationary. I show you some picture. Some film. When I start from nothing, and grain is nothing, and what you see is the vorticity. When initially you have the formation of vortices, and what you see initially is something like the inverse cascade, actually. You have, during the initial stage, you have these vortices that will merge together, and slowly they will form larger and larger scale.
Up. This is 500 squares, 1000 squares, how it's.
Here, no, it's quite small, it's 256. The reason it's quite small is because we will wait for very, very long time, something like 10,000 of turnover times. When it reaches the size box,
it's periodic boundary condition.
It's periodic boundary condition. And we wait for very, very long until it becomes actually stationary. And this is another picture. A very long time after, where it is stationary, then you see the formation of large scale structure. You see that it's still turbulent in the sense that you still have lots of filaments, lots of scale involved, lots of time scale, and on average you have a balance between dissipation on one side and forcing on the other side. But still, at any time, the effect of the inertial terms dominates the effect of the dissipative terms. When you see what we... When there is this time-scale separation, and we ask the question, what will select F in this case? Then, I don't know, but still, there are some points in the parameter range where drastic change occur, and these are actually the phase transition of the equilibrium statistical mechanics. And what I want to do is to find this point, and then to go around empirically and to find the non-equilibrium transition associated to that. Then we have studied we have made a phase diagram of the equilibrium statistical mechanics of this problem, and what we have found.
What are the parameters on the axis?
Alors, the parameters, here it's the energy. The other parameters is A4, something related to the fourth moment of the vorticity. And here there is another parameter, G, which is related to the geometry of the domain. I will use a domain which is rectangular. It will be close to a square, but slightly rectangular. And G is zero for a square, and it's non-zero as soon as I have an aspect ratio which is not equal to one. And then there exists some phase transition. We have studied that using a Lyapunov-Schmidt decomposition, a normal form study. But anyway, the important point physically is that there is this phase transition where you pass from these types of flow, parallel flow, to these other types of flow, the dipole. And it depends on all of these parameters. Then I have already shown you that we were able to see this first type of flow, the dipole. It has been shown by many people. But here you see the systems reaching another type of states, a parallel flow, and what you can see here is the entropy and the energy as a function of time, and you can see that during the transient we pass from one of the two states to the other, and then we are in a statistically stationary state for the parallel flow. Then how could I measure that I am close to some equilibria of the Euler equation? Equilibria of Euler equation are described by relationship, functional relationship between potential vorticity and stream function. Then on a snapshot like this one, I have drawn this plot, omega as a function of psi, and it's the blue line, the light blue line behind. And you can see that it's a line actually, here and there, in the core of the vortex, but it's not at all a line in between. In between you have all these filaments here, which are non-equilibrium features. Then it's close to some equilibrium in this sense. And then when we make temporal average over a time scale which is long compared to a turnover time, all these things are smoothed out by the temporal average, and we obtain a relationship like this one. The same procedure is applied here to this second state, and it's much less convincing, but still we are close in some sense to some equilibria of the Euler equation. Then the point is that because we know there is some sharp transition at some point, we are not able exactly to predict when we will have this state or that state. We don't have a proper kinetic theory for that, but still we know that this line exists somewhere. Then we have empirically tuned the parameters and looked for this transition, and we have obtained it here, changing the aspect ratio. Delta is the aspect ratio. Then for an aspect ratio of 1.02, then it's a nearly square box, we have a statistically stationary regime where we switch randomly from one state to the other as a function of time. Then you see two realizations for two values of the control parameter. And what we say is that thanks to that, we are able to predict such random transition, and we propose several situations that could be studied experimentally. And actually, very recently, I will show you some results by Manny Mathur in Légy in Grenoble, in collaboration with Joël Sommeria, where we find a bistability thanks to this kind of idea. And here it's again a rotating tank experiment. You again have a topography, but it's only on one side. And the flow has been measured on this other side. And this is on this plot here you will see the time average. Time average here for the radial velocity, the velocity like that, and time average here for the zonal velocity, the velocity along this line. And here you have spatio-temporal diagram. Phi is the angle along this line, and here you have the time. Then you see both the average value and the fluctuation. And the point is that if you look at this figure and the next one, they have been obtained for the same value of experimental control parameter, just one more. And then basically here you see that there are two states for the two different values of the control parameter. And we have not been able yet to find some random switch from one to the other, but what we have shown is that there is an hysterical behavior in this rotating tank experiment. And you see this spatio-temporal plot, then the Manny has changed the amplitude of the forcing, this is in volt, proportionally to time. Then this is both the amplitude of the forcing, a control parameter, and time. And you can see that for the same value of the parameters, something different happens when the parameters are decreased, like here, or increased, like here. You see the same switch between the same two types of states, but this occurs at different time. Then this shows that the system is bistable, and what we are doing currently is to try to see actually random switch from one of these states to the other. Then I have finished. I want to conclude, but before this, yesterday Grisha said us that any fluid mechanician should recognize a flow and saying if it's if it's played in the good sense or not, because of reversibility. And now we will test if it's true or not.
Can you play it backward?
by eye make a certain moment out of the floor.
Then you will tell us if it's. I show you a flow. You tell us if it's the natural one or not.
Okay.
Oh, it's simple enough.
That's simple. Yeah, that's simple.
Okay, then tube and flow are
also beautiful.
It's very beautiful.
And tube and flow are actually irreversible and. It's important, as you said yesterday, that all this is independent on viscosity or any dissipative mechanism, this breaking of wave on the large scale.
Is it from the beach?
No,
it's not from the beach.
No, you don't see the surf.
Well, you know, with zoom objective, you're probably okay.
Let me give my conclusion. And I just want to say that we have written recently a physics report on these types of problems with Anton Venaille that has just been accepted for publication. And I want to conclude that when we have shown that ocean rings are statistical equilibria, that the mid-basin strong jet like the Gulf Stream, we think that they are marginally unstable statistical equilibria. And we have predicted and observed non-equilibrium phase transition for the 2D Navier-Stokes equation. And we have observed some equivalent things in experiments. And also, I have not talked about that, but there are more mathematical and more theoretical works on the implicit damping of the 2D Euler equation. The fact that the 2D Euler equation, even if it is time reversible, actually it behaves in an irreversible way. Then we have some works on that and the way it does actually that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.